Hi, and welcome to LeechFest, a medical history podcast where we secure the mosquito nets tight and try our best to avoid praising global imperialism, because today we're talking about malaria, the disease which has been so deadly to humanity as a whole that I don't really have a joke here. Like, it's one of the deadliest diseases to humanity, Homo sapiens, has ever dealt with. So, bummer.
Bummer episode bummer. Once again.
I mean,
y'all ready for a bummer episode?
But before we dive into the mosquitoes of today's episode, I'm Mia.
And I'm Salem.
And how have you been, my dear co-host?
I've been good. I have entered my sourdough bread part of the year, which is when I try to make sourdough bread and fail.
You didn't fail. I thought it was tasty.
I think we are each allowed to our own opinion. So so I have a story about this. So I have my starter. Okay. And first of all, my starter is not super active. And the reason why it's not active is because in Sweden, I don't know how it is in other countries, but in Sweden, radiators don't work in the summer. So our house is forever at like 20 degrees, yeah, maybe. And you need like a warm environment for the starter to you know, become active and for the bread to proof. So I'm blaming that for why my bread turned out dense as fuck.
Yeah.
I actually ended up putting a blanket over my starter to warm it up.
And put it on top of the dishwasher.
Which was your idea. But I think I need to come up with a different solution for this. But anyway, I just wanted an opportunity to bitch about the stupid ass system. I'm so tired of it. Also, warm water is really hard to get by.
Yes, Sweden fucking hates giving you warm water. There's like, this is another thing that like happens in the summer and winter. In the summer, like there is some sort of
this
central heating setting.
No, but it happens
that people
all
just
the time.
Disable sometime in spring.
Okay.
And then you have to wait for 45 minutes before the shower water becomes warm again. Because like, it's all about fucking water conservation here for some reason. Despite us having an abundance of it. Like, Sweden is one of the countries that like does not have to worry about the water wars in the future because we have so fucking much of it. So why do we keep saving it so much?
So my problem is, I haven't had this issue too much personally. My problem is with the tap water and the sink.
Mm.
So the sinks, you'll need to help me explain this because I don't know how to explain it. But basically there's like a, when you turn on the tap, in the sink, mm-hmm, in the bathroom, mm-hmm, in the kitchen,
mm-hmm,
you have to keep it, you have to like push.
You have to continuously apply
pressure
towards
to
the hot water like
to
area.
The lever.
There's one lever. There's not like two knobs or anything. There's like one lever. And if you push it to the warm one, it will be warm. But if you let go of it, it will like reset to like a neutral heat. So that
there's
you don't
like
use too much warm water.
There's a spring or something, so it needs constant tension for the water to be warm.
Mm-hmm.
So we always wash our hands with cold water.
Yeah.
And sometimes I literally have to ask you to like
hold yeah,
the thing for the rare luxury of being able to wash my face with warm water.
I will say, not every tap in Sweden is like this, but a lot of Swedish taps
a lot
are
of
like
it.
This. And I fucking hate it.
I think pretty much every apartment I've lived in had it. My gym has it.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of those.
So
no wonder Swedes are so fucking miserable all the time.
The food is bad, no warm water. Yeah, you're gonna be depressed.
I like the food, to be fair, but I like an akimakia.
That's cold Stockholm syndrome. Anyway, that is my bitching session of the day.
Also, good callback to a previous episode.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm good, but I got sick again, didn't I?
Mm.
I get sick all the time. My immune system is like one white blood cell that's like 400 years old, it's blind, can't see, it's like wandering around my blood circulation system with like a lantern and saying, who goes there?
Who goes there?
And that's my immune system. Mm-hmm. So everyone can get in. It's loose. There's no security at the border.
Not loose.
And I get sick constantly.
You do.
It's like, I hate it.
And that's why also, that is why we are late with this episode, because you've been miserable.
Yeah.
I also got sick from you, except I got better in like 2 days. You've been sick for over a week.
Again, because you have a real immune system.
Yes. But we are here now, aren't we?
That is true. I have spent my time seeking, though, getting having a micro obsession about Neanderthals.
Oh.
And I would love to do some sort of like prehistoric medicine episode sometime, just because of like how
did prehistoric medicine?
Yeah, like how
did, so trepanation?
No, but like how did people do medicine before agriculture?
They drilled holes in hand.
Partially, but there's also other things. Like, I would love to explore this a bit more. But anyway, that's been that. I've been writing a little bit of a short story about Neanderthals discovering an alien ship.
Oh.
Crashing on Earth. And I think that's going to be a fun story.
I'd love to.
15 years.
Read it sometime.
I would love to show you sometime.
Okay. Yes, we would love to thank our patrons for supporting this episode. If you didn't know, patrons get access to notes, Patreon posts, they get to suggest episode topics sometimes, and they also get to see a video version of this podcast with us in it.
Yes.
You get to see us record, and you get to see my cool editing. You also get a chance for an in-episode shout-out if you're a patron. And we have a very special person to thank this episode, and that person is Danica West.
Thank you, Danica. Thank you for supporting the podcast and making sure we are able to keep making episodes continuously so that we can both make silly episodes, which we occasionally do, but also like actual real episodes about real diseases like malaria. We also hope that you hate mosquitoes, Danica, because if you don't, you will after this episode.
Before we get into the episode, we have a Spotify comment. Not a question, a comment.
A comment.
It was on the Bugs as Drugs episode. Max Emerald says, I've listened to this episode and the flesh-eating bacteria episode a few times, and I am very normal about them. Anything about medicine, bugs, or microbes makes me happy. Haha. Love this. Well, that makes two of us, Max Emerald, because I'm also very normal about medicine, bugs, and microbes.
And how lucky for you. There's going to be more bugs today.
More bugs in today's episode.
And with that, let's begin our anti-mosquito hate rant.
So Mia, are you ready for the sciencey part of this episode?
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to sit confused like a dog.
Like a dog.
Drooling, listening to someone talk to me and not understanding.
You don't understand, but you can listen.
I can listen.
Okay.
If you ever listen to this episode and you don't understand what Sam is talking about, I'm you, dear listener. Like, I feel for you. I still don't really know what a protein is. But that's a different question.
That's a different question for another episode.
What's malaria, Sam?
So first of all, do you know where the word malaria comes from? And I know you do. But I'm going to pretend you don't. So it comes from the Italian term mal aria, which means bad air, to represent the association of the disease with marshy areas. Marshes are wet and humid and gross and weird.
Stinky.
And creepy. And you know who likes all of those things? Mosquitoes.
And my ancestors.
Why?
They lived in swamps. True fact.
So, the Italians had the right idea, but let me not get ahead of myself. Let me give you the modern definition of malaria. It is an endemic vector-borne parasitic disease. And the endemic part means that it is common in certain areas of the world, specifically tropical and subtropical regions, globally, but it's especially common in sub-Saharan Africa.
I think do you mind if I jump in here?
Yeah,
also?
Go ahead.
Because I think I mentioned this a bit later as well, but I think that there's... It's good to point out like the definition of like endemic compared to like epidemic diseases, right? Because endemic just means it's always there. It's just around continuously.
Whereas
epidemic is like it comes and goes, like it can break out.
So I mean, malaria does have seasons.
Yes.
It is more common in the warm part of the year. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It is kind of always there. Mm-hmm.
This becomes relevant later, so yes, I just wanted to establish
it becomes
that.
Relevant later. So the disease itself is caused by a protozoan, which is a single-celled eukaryote.
Because it's not a virus, it's not a bacteria, it's just a little guy.
It's a little
like
guy.
A little creature.
It's a little guy. It's a little parasite of the genus Plasmodium, which is carried by a vector. And specifically, it's carried by the female mosquito of the Anopheles species. Anopheles? Anopheles.
Women be vectors.
Women be vectoring. And there are five different species of Plasmodium, which causes malaria in humans, but falciparum is the one that gets the most attention because it's the main one. It's quite common and it causes severe or complicated malaria, so it has the worst symptoms.
Yeah.
So malaria infection can cause a range of symptoms, varying from mild headache to seizures, coma, and other neurological abnormalities, which can and do very often lead to death. The symptoms which are often used as telltale signs of malaria are shivering, fever, sweating, gastrointestinal distress, but these symptoms can be present in other febrile diseases like dengue fever, typhoid fever, and pneumonia, which is why parasitological tests are required to confirm the diagnosis. Of course, an issue with that is that in some areas, testing facilities are not readily available, which often leads to improper diagnosis and unnecessary use of anti-malarial drugs, which ultimately leads to side effects, firstly, but also the spread of drug resistance, which is a big problem in some parts of the world, especially with falciparum infections. So a few words about the parasite itself, the star of the show. So as mentioned, malaria transmission involves the Plasmodium parasite and the mosquito vector carrying it. And the parasite is really interesting because it has a number of life stages and it changes in shape and behavior as it moves from the vector into the host or the human and also between the different cell types of the host.
Mm.
So shortly, the parasites reside in the mosquito's salivary gland and are released to the bloodstream of the human as the mosquito feeds. At this stage, the parasite is very motile. It travels to the person's hepatocytes, meaning their liver cells, where they undergo asexual reproduction until the hepatocytes burst forth.
What does motile mean?
It moves very fast and very easily. So it multiplies inside the liver cells until the liver cells literally burst and like spurt forth like a lot of parasites.
Mm-hmm. Gushing.
Gushing with parasites, which then invade erythrocytes, the red blood cells. It is at this stage that the symptoms of malaria start to appear. In the blood cells, in the red blood cells specifically, the parasites undergo the second round of asexual reproduction. But at this stage, the daughter parasites also begin to mature into female and male sexual progeny, or gametocytes, and can undergo sexual reproduction as well.
Hmm.
It is the gametocytes that are taken up into the mosquito's midgut when it feeds again. And so they enter the mosquito and there they further mature to a stage where they can infect another person.
Jesus.
So I mentioned that it's at the erythrocytic stage that the parasite causes symptoms. And probably unsurprising, the symptoms are caused by the activation of our old friend, the immune system, and the release of cytokines, which we've also mentioned, which leads to fever, chills, sweats, gastrointestinal distress, like I said, and other systemic symptoms. In the case of severe malaria, the infected erythrocytes adhere to capillary walls, leading to the obstruction of microcirculation, individual tissue anoxia, meaning lack of oxygen, because red blood cells cannot bring oxygen to tissues anymore. In the brain, this causes cerebral malaria, in the kidneys, tubular necrosis and renal failure, in the intestines, ischemia and ulceration. And intestinal ulceration can have further consequences. As you know, intestines are full of bacteria, and so ulceration can lead to the release of pathogenic bacteria, leading to bacteremia, which causes further complications. So it's like, it's a shitstorm.
Mm. Hate that.
Hate that. An interesting fact about malaria is that some people develop resistance to it via acquired immunity. In malarious regions, the prevalence and severity of malaria infections decrease with age as people develop antibodies against the parasite at its various life stages. Also, the acquired antibodies are transferred from the mother to the fetus across the placenta. Unfortunately, the immunity only lasts between 6 to 9 months as it does in adults. Additionally, some people carry a major resistance factor against malaria, and that is sickle cell anemia. You've probably heard of it. So, just a few words. Sickle cell anemia is an inherited disorder, which causes hemoglobin, which is the protein that carries oxygen, to be malformed. Normally, blood cells are disc-shaped and pliable, which allows them to move freely through blood vessels. But in sickle cell anemia, they become hard and sticky and take on a crescent or a sickle shape.
I'm very glad that you're mentioning this because I had I have a segment like later on in mm-hmm. my history segment mentioning sickle cell, and I'm too stupid to explain how that works. I'm so glad you're explaining like how it works, because I tried to read like a summary, like explain sickle cell for dummies, and I was like, the shape of the blood cell and like the gene expression distribution spread. And I'm like, I don't understand them.
So the blood cells become sticky and hard, and they take on this sickle shape. And this has a number of consequences. Firstly, sickle cells tend to die early, which causes a constant shortage of blood cells. They also tend to get stuck and clog blood flow, causing a number of cardiovascular complications. This is especially true for people who have two copies of the mutation. On the upside, people who only have one copy of the mutant gene are partially protected from severe malaria. They have some symptoms, but they're also protected. Compared to people who have normal hemoglobin, heterozygous people have a 50 to 90% reduction in parasite density. It's still unclear what the protective mechanism is, but the leading hypothesis is that sickle-shaped red blood cells lack a protein, favorite concept, which mediates their adhesion to the blood vessel wall, which decreases the risk of tissue anoxia. Another protection mechanism against malaria is the absence of the Duffy blood antigen, which is a receptor on the surface of red blood cells that one species of the parasite, specifically P. vivax, needs in order to invade these cells, so they just can't enter red blood cells.
Hmm.
When absent...
No admittance.
It can't enter the red blood cells or in like advanced fruits life stages. So yeah, it's just stuck.
Not on the list.
Can't get in. The Duffy null phenotype is the most common phenotype in people of African descent. And likely that is the result of positive selection pressure.
I should mention this here as well. I'm just moving it from my section, moving up because it's so fitting here.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a range distribution map. Mm-hmm. Specifically of sickle cell, but like also like other sort of like protective changes that the body does against malaria, and like the distribution of those changes, and they overlap perfectly with malaria distribution.
Mm.
So like where there's malaria, people have sickle cell.
Yeah.
Like if there's no malaria, people don't have sickle cell. And maybe you mentioned this. I would hate to like say your thing as well. But like in areas that have had endemic malaria but no longer have it, sickle cell rates go down.
Really? I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, so it's going away in areas that don't have malaria. I mean, I think that's so interesting. Mm. They're only now noticing it in places like Algeria, for example.
Hmm.
So
that's
cool, right?
Really cool. Let's talk about diagnosis and treatment really quick. So I mentioned this previously, but the diagnosis process varies depending on available resources, which often depends on geographical region. And this is like a big topic with malaria.
Mm.
But in any case, the first step in diagnosis is a physical examination, which should be followed by laboratory tests because a lot of malaria symptoms are very general. The laboratory tests include a blood count and a chemistry panel. And there are several methods for detecting the presence of parasites as well as the species involved. The classic one is the blood smear test, in which a blood sample from the patient is placed on a microscopy slide after being stained with the GIMSA stain, which is a blue stain that dyes the parasite's nucleus. So you can see it, you know, among red blood cells. The technician can then observe the slide on the microscope and look for the presence of parasites. And actually, I've done this before in my undergrad.
Oh.
They gave us slides to examine. And it's really laborious and it requires a lot of expertise, especially if you're trying to look for different species. So yeah, it requires a lot of know-how. Rapid diagnostic tests are a popular alternative because they're kind of automatic. Like you just put in the blood and you get the answer. Like, is there a parasite? Is there not?
Hmm.
And they're not limited by the technician's experience or subjectivity, because that's the other thing with the microscopy slides. You know, different people can see different things.
Mm.
You can also do PCR to detect parasitic DNA, but this requires pretty advanced equipment and, again, expertise. In the case of a positive malaria test, several tests can be done to distinguish between uncomplicated and severe malaria, specifically tests detecting anemia, hypoglycemia, and renal failure. Additionally, you can also run drug resistance tests.
Oh.
in which parasites are collected in grown in culture in the presence of increasing concentrations of antimalarial drugs, which is really fancy and, again, time-consuming and resource-intensive, mm-hmm. and is not something that is really present or available in a lot of parts of the world.
Yeah, seems like something you could do, like, in Sweden mm-hmm. or, like, in Canada, mm-hmm. maybe not in, like, sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah. But anyway, the drug concentration that inhibits parasite growth is basically what you get as part of your treatment. Mm. And if you want to get real fancy, you can also do molecular characterization, where certain molecular markers that may indicate a drug resistance are analyzed via PCR or gene sequencing.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, it seems like there are so many fancy methods, and then there's one where you just dip it in blood, like dip it in enough liquid, mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. it just tells you if you have it.
Yeah.
It seems like that one should be the...
Should be the main
Can
one.
Can you scale that one up?
Yeah, exactly.
That seems like the easiest solution here.
Yeah. So malaria diagnosis is often limited to physical examinations, microscopy analysis, and rapid diagnostic tests in the regions where diagnosis, like an accurate diagnosis, is needed the most. As far as treatment goes, again, like I keep mentioning this, but there's a large gap between approaches in resource-rich and resource-poor regions. Mm. And the recommendation is the use of combination treatment with at least two antimalarial agents with different mechanisms of action. And this is because it's really important to reduce the risk of drug resistance, but it's also a way to maximize effectiveness of the treatment. So as malaria is an acute infection, which can evolve and become lethal very quickly, patients should be diagnosed and treated as soon as possible. The choice of treatment is dependent on the Plasmodium species causing the infection, the clinical status of the patient, the drug susceptibility of the parasite, which is usually determined by the geographic area where the infection was acquired, because we know that there are certain regions where drug resistance is very common.
Oh, so like the Plasmodiums of these couple of swamps mm-hmm. are more resistant than the Plasmodium of the other type of swamps over there. That's so interesting.
Yeah, especially the falciparum. There's a few areas where I think chloroquine? Is that the... Chloroquine? So there's some areas where chloroquine used to be prescribed a lot, and it's led to resistance of falciparum specifically. So if it's falciparum, they tend to prescribe other types of medications.
And then if it's like Vivax or something, then they're fine.
Yeah, basically.
Because they're different species. I think that that's super cool too. Like a whole ass different species of parasite creature that act different and have a complete... This is another thing that I kind of want to quickly mention too. But like, because we mentioned falciparum. I can't pronounce it. Falciparum the most, and that's because it's the most common one.
And it causes the worst symptoms.
And there might be a reason for why it causes the worst symptoms as well. It's because it shares a different evolutionary path mm-hmm. than every other malaria species. Because all the other ones are basically, they come from the same ones as most malaria that infest primates in general and mammals in general. But falciparum comes initially from like the Ur parasite, the first parasite like 150 million years ago or something like that. But then that jumped to birds and then jumped back to humans.
Okay.
It's done that kind of weird jump.
Okay.
And that makes it stand out from the other malaria species.
That's interesting. But you're going to talk to us about that later. It's still my turn.
I'm sorry.
So I mentioned that it's really vital to determine the infecting species of parasite. And that's because, like we mentioned, some species, the falciparum, but also the Nolesi species are more likely to cause severe disease than the other Plasmodium species. They're called P. vivax, P. ovale, and P. malariae. These Latin words, bro, like...
Isn't it just P. malaria?
P. malaria, sure.
That's how I thought again. Also, what you said something called like Nolesi?
Nolesi.
That's me in this podcast.
Nolesi.
Nolesi. You're no more.
Also, I love how there's five species. They all cause malaria, mm-hmm. but only one of them is called P. malaria. And it's not even the main one.
It's not the first one.
Clear favoritism there.
I know, right?
So... Yes, so two of them cause severe disease, but there's also another two, Vivax and Ovale. They have this very annoying tendency to remain dormant in the liver and cause recurrent episodes. So you might be treating the red blood stage, but then guess what? Like 3 months later, malaria again. So they require a specific treatment targeting that specific life stage. And then I mentioned that falciparum and also vivax have different drug resistance patterns in certain parts of the world. So that needs to be taken into account. And there are a few different lines of treatment. The one that most people know about is chloroquine, which is still used against most species of Plasmodium, except for falciparum, like I said, because it has a high rate of resistance. And I just wanted to mention briefly how it works. So if you remember, the parasite proliferates in red blood cells, consuming the hemoglobin. They love this protein. They eat it up for amino acids.
Yeah, and we need it.
So the consumption of hemoglobin releases a product, an oxidized form of heme, which is toxic to the parasite. Usually the parasite has a really smart way to fix that. It's able to convert it into a non-toxic compound, but chloroquine prevents it from doing so. So the parasite chokes and dies.
Oh, get wrecked, nerd.
Get wrecked, nerd. Other than chloroquine, there's a few other popular anti-malaria drug combinations, which is AL, camoquine, and Malrone. I'm not going to talk too much, like mention what like the exact medicines that are included, because nobody's going to remember that and, you know, whatever. But mostly they work by either producing toxic heme, causing the release of free radicals, which damage the parasite, or by inhibiting the mitochondrial electron chain, which decreases the parasite's production of ATP. And it just like, you know, messes up all their internal processes.
Makes them lazy.
Well, it's...
Makes them tired. Parasite's too EP. No ATP.
It's like a car running out of juice. No power to do anything.
It gives them depression.
So, quickly, before I finish my section, there are currently 2 vaccines against falciparum. And I specify, it's only falciparum. The other ones are not, there's no vaccine against the other species.
And even the ones that exist are quite recent, right?
They were approved by WHO in 2021 and 2023 in October. Wow. So very recent. They're called RTS-S and R21. The R21 vaccine has been shown to reduce symptomatic cases by 75% during the year following a free dose series, which is very promising.
That's great.
However, there's still a large discrepancy between supply and demand. And again, the only target is the falciparum species. But it is believed that the implementation of vaccine programs will lead to a reduction in the burden of disease. So that's good. That's hopeful. There is, however, one factor which might contribute to an increase in malaria incidence in the future. I will be talking about that at the end of the episode.
Okay. So as we go into this section in the history of malaria, I almost got lost in the sauce. You need sauce, but a man can get lost in the sauce. And the history of malaria is so huge, gigantic. It's the biggest. Trump voice, like, huge.
Huge,
the best. We got the best history. Because it's so impactful to all human cultures. It has existed all across the world, and it has existed for as long as there have been humans. Malaria itself, like the Plasmodium, has probably existed for longer than there has been Homo sapiens.
Many such cases.
And it has evolved with us. So it's like it's our evolutionary buddy, which is not that great. Professor Brian Farragher estimates in a BBC radio show called More or Less that up to 5% of all humans who have ever lived have died of malaria.
Fuck.
I know, right?
That's a lot.
There's a common statement that has been repeated, like, it was published in Nature, and it's not true. Like, it can't be true. Statistically, it's impossible. That 50% of humans have died to malaria. And that has been repeated by, like, you know, quiz shows and, like, fun fact things. It's so not true. It's statistically impossible.
But how do you know? I mean, Nature is one of the best medical journals around.
There's no source.
What?
There's no source to it. It's just mentioned. They could be up to 50%. And then a bunch of other, like, respectable institutions have referred back to that one. But asking for an original source for that statement... there's nothing. You can't find it.
We should email the corresponding offer and be like, hey,
this doesn't make any fucking sense. No, because, like, even statistically, like, malaria doesn't even have a 50% death rate most of the time. So, like...
Well, now.
Yeah.
Throughout history.
But even in history, actually. Anyway, but anyway, it's not... That's not super important. Today, many people associate malaria with Africa. Like, they have a mental image of Bill Gates, probably, standing in a white shirt next to a doctor who stands next to a hippo giving them, like, an injection of some sort. That's, I think, the mental image a lot of people, like, associate with malaria. And it is true that falciparum is limited to tropical climates. But malaria has been a danger on every single continent except Antarctica. And there have been cases even here in Sweden. Even above the polar circle. Weird, right? But historically, the types that were the most common was not falciparum, but were vivax and malarium. Those were the substrains that were probably the most common, at least in the medical literature that we know about. And a reason for that might also be that they cause quite specific symptoms that could be easily identified by ancient and previous medical cultures. Vivax, for example, causes a fever every 2 days, and malarium causes a fever roughly every 3 days, with like very regular intervals. Falciparum causes like a continuous fever though, so that's a bit more difficult to sort of like suss out as being like a specific thing. Because malaria is such an old disease, it was of course known by the ancients. Medical texts from all around the ancient world mention disease which was almost certainly malaria, such as the Chinese Huang Di Nijing from 2700 BCE, which describes it as being caused by three demons.
I love a good demon story. I love it when they associate disease with demons.
I will say, this is like, it's not that they believed that actual demons were causing the disease, but it's a good way to remember it by and like to tell the story about how it works. Like, it's a figurative language.
Like a metaphor.
Yeah, kind of. And these three demons are armed, one with a hammer, one with a pail of water, and one with a stove. And this represents headaches, chills, and fever, respectively.
So poetic. I love it.
I know, but isn't that also like such a smart way? Just like, imagine that you're a Chinese doctor 5,000 years ago, and you know this, like, as a fact, and you have to teach this to other people. Like, are you going to teach people being like, this is fever, this is cause of this, like, but you can tell a nice story that can spread, and then you, like, it'll... Science communication. And these symptoms were described distinctly with fever every other day, so it probably doesn't refer to falciparum, but malaria. And the symptoms were described distinctly with fever every other day, so it probably refers to vivax of this various subtypes. A disease is also mentioned in the Vedic text Atharvarda from around 1000 BCE with distinction in the Charms to Cure Diseases and Possessions by Demons of Disease, which is about the fever demon Takman, and goes as follows. Destroy the Takman that returns on each third day, the one that intermits each third day, the one that continues without intermission, and the autumnal one. Destroy the cold Takman, the hot, him that comes in summer, and him that arrives in the rainy season.
Weren't wrong?
Hyper-specific. Like, it's very much like, these are the symptoms, it comes down, rainy season, comes in autumn, like, it's seasonal things, every 2 days. Like, it's,
yeah.
This is a medical text.
Yeah. It's not bad.
It's not bad. There is the very previous line, though, in that hymn, is like, we pray that Takman will remove here and go to our neighbors.
Wait, what does it say?
I don't remember the specifics because I cut it for length, but like it's a thing that's like, Takman, go and bother the neighbors. Like, don't come to us. Stop bothering us. Go to the neighbors instead. The foreigners, even, I think it says.
The foreigners.
It's a kind of
okay, that's a little sussy.
I know.
That's a little sketch.
The Egyptians and Greeks also knew of malaria. The Egyptians, however, didn't write about it a lot, unfortunately. Egyptian texts were often written to paint the pharaohs in a positive light, and writing about a disease that cannot be stopped and that it's like exists in marshy areas, which is kind of, you know, the Nile, goes against that narrative a little bit. But they did, however, keep mummies around, and we know from testing them that they suffered from malaria. But again, that's not super unexpected. The Nile was very marshy and had a lot of wetlands around it. Not anymore, because there's a dam. The Nile doesn't even flood anymore. One good example of the Egyptians like not writing bad things about themselves is about the Battle of Kadesh, which was between ancient Egypt and the Hittites. And historical records from ancient Egypt and the Hittite Empire both say that they won, like a smashing victory against the Hittites.
Do we know who won?
They think it was the Hittites. But they're not sure. It could be who knows?
I feel like my version of the protein is the Hittites, because you've mentioned them a few times on the podcast. I still don't know. I still don't know who they were.
A lot of people don't know about the Hittites. The Greeks also wrote frequently about malaria, and they also discerned the frequency of the fevers and categorized them as such. Malaria was very common in ancient Greece, and we know this because it's not just scholars who wrote about it. Malaria is mentioned in plays, along with the signs of its coming. Homer mentions it in the Iliad as appearing at the same time as the star Sirius, which happens in the summer. It used to happen in the summer, but because of astrophysics, now it happens later. It used to happen in July, now it happens like August sometime, just because it's coming closer.
Mm-hmm.
Hippocrates also wrote about the disease and also mentioned the fever cycles, as well as some cases occurring in the winter, which means he was probably writing about vivax and malarium. Falciparum was also present in ancient Greece and was probably responsible for absolutely trashing Greek forces during a war with Syracuse around 2,500 years ago, something that the Greeks would have no resistance against. This may have led to the death of the original desert twink, Alexander the Great.
Not the twink.
I know. But the original Paul Atreides in the desert. Before I go on to the Romans, I want to quickly mention the theories that people had about what malaria was and their reactions to it, including the Romans. We've mentioned the origin of the name being Old Italian for bad air, which is a phrase we've heard before on this podcast. Disease being caused by bad air. That is the miasma theory. And it's not true, but it's something that has been around since the ancient Greeks and probably long before. And that was the dominant theory of what was causing malaria for many of these ancient cultures, including Chinese ones who did not collaborate with the Greeks or anything, but independently considered malaria to be caused by malaria gas. Again, probably associating it with swamps and swamp gas, which tend to belch out stinky fumes, which they do. They could also see that the people who were most affected by malaria were the people who lived close to wetlands or in wetlands. And I mention this here because some of the best Roman writing about malaria comes not from our favorite Roman medical boy Galen, but from a farmer, Columella, who wrote about how best to farm. In his book, De Re Rustica, he gives advice on how to avoid common mistakes and general tips about farming.
Wait, when was this?
In ancient Rome.
A farmer wrote a book?
I mean, farmer in the Roman Empire is less out in the field hoeing.
Like
and
a landowner.
Yeah, kind of. He deals with farming, by which he owns slaves who does the farming, and he manages it, basically. That's his job.
Important distinction.
That's, yes. I'm hesitant to say, a little bit like farmers today, but instead of slaves, they use tools today. But you're not out in the field, doing this. They're not serfs. But yes, he wrote a book. You're an academic. But not a scientist in that sense, but more a landowner who had good ideas.
Slaves.
Well, some of them were kind of really bad ideas against slaves. He has tables of how many slaves per square meter of farmland that you have, depending on the fertility of the soil. It's he got this down to a science. And he has advice, don't set up your houses near stagnant water. Good advice. But he also has some other good nuggets of advice, which I want to give an example of here.
The farmers out there.
Yes, for all the farmers out there, but also just anyone. It's as true today as it was in ancient times. If there are no enclosures, the boundaries of the estate are made more secure by the planting of trees, which prevent the servants from quarreling with the neighbors.
I love that was a problem that was so frequent that it needed fixing.
Yeah.
People needed solutions.
Either build a fence, a big wall, or plant a wall of trees. We can't have the servants quarreling. There's also another advice, which comes slightly after, which is you need dogs. If you don't have dogs, what are you doing?
Do the dogs...
Farms need dogs.
Wait, for the servants quarreling or for other purposes?
For safety of the farm.
Safety of the farm.
But the thing that sticks
not
out...
Not today. Dogs these days, you know how they are.
They're millennials, right? But the thing that sticks out in his writing is that Columella doesn't just warn against building near to swamps to avoid bad air, but because of the mosquitoes that infested them, and warning that they could spread the disease. He's...
Smart cookie?
He immediately, it's the mosquitoes. They spread disease. They do it. Not fucking air. Farmers, stay winning. Farmers won all of medical science about malaria up until like 1800-0.
Galen who? My man Columella figured it out.
There's a few statues of him like around Spain, mm-hmm. And he is depicted with a sickle because of like his innovations in agriculture. But what did all of these cultures use for treatment, you may ask? Mostly, it was a variety of herbal remedies. But one herbal remedy stands out. Ancient Chinese texts frequently mention an herb called Qinghao, which refer to a group of plants in the Artemisia family, which is the same herb used in traditional absinthe, funnily enough.
Interesting overlap that I did not expect.
Me neither, right? And it was described in dozens of medical texts as having anti-fever properties. But it wasn't refined, and there was no standard preparation. But let's put a pin in that herb for a moment. Like, let's not forget about that herb, dear listener.
Bink!
I would mention ancient American history, but malaria didn't exist there at all until European colonization, when it spread there via enslaved Africans. Archaeologists are currently fighting about how crossings into America happened, like in ancient times, how Native Americans got there. But however it happened, they never brought malaria with them. So that was the history of malaria, the disease. But there was, of course, the history of malaria, the Empire Strikes Back. Because imperialism is another significant aspect of malaria that a lot of people tend to forget. Malaria, at the time of the 18th and 19th century, had become a global problem. But it was especially bad in tropical climates, where falciparum thrives. But because people living in tropical climates, like West Africa, had dealt with malaria for a long time, they had developed more resistances than other groups around the world. We mentioned this before, like sickle cell and other like adaptations. This presents a problem. If you're a European imperialist who wants to increase palm oil exports to Europe, because whenever Europeans go to West Africa to steal it, they end up dead, don't they? And boy, oh boy, do Europeans die in West Africa. The average death rate for all Europeans, just generally, was around 11% per year from just regular background malaria.
From just malaria, not like we're sure it was malaria.
From just malaria. Like there are multiple stories of like this expedition, 92 dead, only 3 dead from like disease or like other diseases or like combat wounds, and then like 90 of them just dead from malaria specifically. Mm. And during epidemics, this death rate could rise as high as 80%. So 800 out of 1,000 would die from malaria. West Africa then became known as the white man's grave. And that actually brings us to the first effective standard medicine against malaria, quinine. Quinine is a compound that is found in the bark of the cinchona tree, which is native to South America. Indigenous peoples of the area were using it as a healing powder against fevers, and there's a local legend about its discovery, about an indigenous man who was delirious with fever, stumbling through the jungle, and who drank from a stagnant pool of water, which tasted bitter. But instead of getting sick and poisoned, his fever lifted, and he discovered that the pool of water had been infused by the bark of the trees around it. But obviously this is a legend, and it's probably not true. But it wasn't until quinine itself was isolated in 1820 by French chemists Pierre-Joseph Pelletier and Joseph Bien-Aimé Caventou that quinine could be purified and made to be a truly potent medicine for malaria. And the trees had then become known as fever trees, and they were super valuable at this time. Because malaria exists at this point in every continent around the world. So like it's the worst in West Africa, but everyone is suffering from malaria everywhere, kind of, a little bit, including here in Sweden.
Is it the bark itself that has the compound that was isolated, or did it come from different parts of the tree?
The bark, yeah.
The bark itself.
Yes. Mm. And suddenly, when they managed to sort of like isolate quinine from the bark, these fever trees became like one of the hottest commodities in the global economy at the time. Mm. So because both like every doctor and hospital wants to have a little bit of it, individuals want it because no one wants to have malaria, trading companies want it because they're trading in India and China and Africa, the military wants it so that they can conquer Africa. Like everyone wants more and more of this stuff, and it's only found in South America. But if you're a big fan of MAPCO change history, you also know of another thing that happened in 1820 South America, the South American Wars of Independence. Just as quinine was becoming massively important, Peru and other countries that had the trees now had independent control over this resource, and they banned the export of seeds and saplings of the trees so that they themselves could maintain the monopoly over the sale of the bark.
Smart business move.
It's a very smart business move. It actually ends up making, at some point, up to 15% of the total tax income of Bolivia, which is a lot for just bark. They actually even, like, hide many of the plantations. And Europeans, some countries even instituted secret police forces that would, like, track
to
down
guard.
And hunt plant smugglers.
Hunt them down?
Yes. In some areas, Europeans were just, like, not allowed for fear that they could be plant hunters. So, like, this was a massive thing. Because they knew that, like, the second this tree can be grown somewhere else, they lose the monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately for South America, eventually, around the 1840s, seeds were managed to be smuggled out. And new plantations were set up in Indonesia and India by the Dutch and British, respectively. One of the plantations that become, like, the most productive is on the island of Java. In Indonesia. So now that they had managed to screw the South Americans out of their natural resources, their eyes were set on African national resources. The Berlin Conference happened in 1884, the scramble for Africa happened, and the rest, as they say, is history. Because suddenly now, you could have your military expeditions into Africa without all your soldiers dying. And after a while, once you start getting a bit of a foothold into Africa, many of the militaries began drafting, like, local forces that already had the resistance, and at that point it snowballed. Quinine gave European powers, like, the foot in the door. Around the same time, in 1880, a French doctor by the name of Charles Laveran discovered that malaria was caused by a parasite by examining the blood of patients and seeing little spheres with flagella-like organs, and observed that they were removed by quinine, which was by then a known treatment for malaria. But when pressed to find the origin of the parasite, he couldn't find it in soil or water samples, and so he eventually reasoned that it had to exist in another animal. And he already knew that mosquitoes could carry other types of parasites, like there's a type of worm that can be carried by mosquitoes. And that had led him to investigate and then confirm that mosquitoes were the main vector. While quinine helped to facilitate the expansion of imperialism in Africa, it also laid the groundwork for eradicating malaria in many areas around the world that suffered from outbreaks, but where it wasn't fully endemic. Combined with the discovery that it was carried by mosquitoes, states now had a solid path to getting rid of it. This led multiple nations, and even wealthy individuals, to institute malaria eradication programs, or malaria eradication societies, a tradition that is upheld by Bill Gates to this day. The most effective method was to wage total war against mosquitoes. You can cure a lot of people, or treat them. But that's not going to prevent you from being a temporary host. It's not going to get rid of, like, the root. But if you can kill every last fucking mosquito, you can get them. Putting up nets became commonplace. But building canals, draining swamps, as well as building embankment on rivers, that was the most effective methods of dealing with malaria outbreaks. This was a massive geoengineering project that was helped by the fact that during this time, people were also moving from villages into cities during industrialization. And cities typically don't have swamps full of mosquitoes. And this effort began first in northern climates, where malaria epidemics had not been super stable, which reduced the barrier for eradication. And then it progressed gradually southward. And this took a long time. I think people overestimate how long ago this was, because malaria wasn't eliminated in Europe until just a few decades ago. The Second World War even set back some efforts, partly due to war destroying infrastructure, and partly by deliberate action. When the Nazis knew that the Allies were going to invade Sicily, the Germans deliberately destroyed all the water infrastructure in the hopes that malaria would thrive there and hinder the Allied advance. But the war also led to supply issues, so the Allies had to use different medication, which was less effective. The island of Java at this point was occupied by the Japanese, so suddenly all the good trees are gone.
Why didn't they get it from South America?
Not enough. Like, talking about, like, the scale here, like, there were millions of tons of bark per year being exported from just South America. So, like, the South American quinine economy, it took a hit when they lost the monopoly. But not by that much, just because, like, the the demand was huge.
I'm also wondering, do you, like, stripping the bark, does this damage the tree?
I'm not sure, actually.
Because I'm also wondering about the effect on, you know, local climate and local, like, forestry.
But
did it lead to deforestation? Or was...
I will say they had plantations for this, for their stuff. Like, they deliberately grew massive fields of just this tree, specifically for the bark. So, like, it's possible that initially there was some deforestation, but they grew more of this so they could keep getting more and more of the bark.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly how it, like, led to more, how do you say, like, deforestation or, like, environmental impact.
Yeah, I guess I'm just kind of curious how they actually got it from the tree. I wonder if they had to cut the tree down for it, or if they could just, if it was, like, a renewable thing.
I think it was a renewable thing, but don't take my word on that. But because some of the medication was less effective during the war, you need other things as well to sort of make sure that all the soldiers and also people don't get malaria. And what the US military did, for example, I think stands out a little bit, because this was also, like, similar methods were applied by many militaries around the world, but the US military is, I think, the most significant, because they were also the ones who ramped up, like, alternative medicine production against malaria. But one thing that they did was to apply insecticides, because that is also a good way to make sure that you're not bitten by mosquitoes if all the mosquitoes are dead. But because you don't know exactly where mosquitoes are, one thing you can do is just apply insecticide directly to the soldiers.
Okay.
Just, like, slather your skin in insecticides, and that's going to be great. And yes, dear listener, the insecticide that you're thinking of is the one it is, because it was the miracle of DDT, which you may have heard about, and if you know anything about it, you know that DDT could have its own episode on this podcast.
I'm good. I don't know super much. Is it super toxic?
Oh, it's so bad.
Okay.
It's so bad.
Okay.
But it does kill the fuck out of mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that, like, after the war, when the World Health Organization was founded in 1948, DDT was instrumental in, like, the eradication efforts against malaria in most of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not great. Mm-hmm. It's like, as an insecticide for people. It kills bald eagles. It kills birds. It kills you.
Yeah,
But it does kill the fuck out of mosquitoes. So, like, even today, it's actually quite difficult to find an insecticide that's more effective against mosquitoes than DDT. So it's still used in some eradication efforts, because statistically, you will save more lives by killing more mosquitoes than you will by basically causing cancer to increase in the areas where you're using it.
Damn, why are toxic things so useful? This reminds me of lead, like how lead is just amazing.
Yeah.
And also, what's the other one? We talked about it.
Asbestos.
Asbestos. Asbestos also. Amazing.
Amazing insulation. Great. Doesn't catch on fire. Flame retardant.
Cheap.
Good insulation. Cheap.
Will
sturdy.
Sturdy, yeah.
Will kill you.
Will kill you. But it's so good though.
Binds paint perfectly. Sweetens food. Makes gas more reliable, lasts longer, engines work better, will kill you and the planet.
Okay, go ahead.
Everything good sucks. Using the previously mentioned methods, malaria was gradually eradicated from the US in 1951, Europe in 1973, and China in 2021, which, good job China, I didn't even hear about this until I did research for this episode. Especially considering that China has had, like, endemic malaria compared to, like, Europe, which haven't really had that.
Mm-hmm.
So, hell yeah.
Good job, China.
In the middle of the COVID pandemic, they're like, we're going to take care of malaria too. Most of the eradication that happened in highly industrialized urban nations, and mostly affected the more benign subtypes that aren't restricted to tropical climates. Falciparum, though, is still dominant in areas like sub-Saharan Africa and Papua New Guinea, and those are also areas which are not as urbanized and not as wealthy when it comes to their medical infrastructure, or with their water infrastructure for that matter, which is also very significant. So, it's once again a distribution problem rather than a technology problem.
Mm.
However, more and more nations keep reaching eradication status. The most recent was Cabo Verde, which eradicated it at the start of this year. Hell yeah, Cabo Verde. It's the third African country to eradicate malaria. And global progress is also being made, with death rates declining more and more. Although, I hate to say this, the COVID pandemic did set back eradication efforts by over a decade.
Mm.
Like, there's a wonderful, like, downward slope of malaria deaths. And then in, like, 2020, it's just like a beep. Like, right up, I hate it. But there's also medical progress, such as the development of medicines, such as artemisinin. How do you pronounce that? Artemisinin?
I would...
Because there are two N's.
Hold on. Artemisinin.
Artemisinin.
Artemisinin, probably. That probably sounds right.
I heard contrasting things. Yeah. So.
I never know how to pronounce medication. Like, whenever we talk about specific medication names, I'm completely lost.
Artemisinin is a compound discovered by Chinese scientist Tu Youyou, who won a Nobel Prize in Medicine for this discovery in 2015. And in her Nobel lecture, she talks about her discovery and the importance of not discrediting actual historical traditional medicine. And this is where we end up, much like the last episode, with communism once again, because artemisinin finds its origins in the Vietnam War. Vietnam in 1967 was plagued by malaria, and Americans, who were dropping bombs, which doesn't really help the global eradication effort.
Mm-hmm.
Ho Chi Minh asked Mao Zedong to help, who then instituted a secret military coordination unit called Unit 523, named after the date it was created, which got massive resources and authority in the fight against malaria. Tu Youyou was placed in charge of the division tasked with examining traditional Chinese medicine to see if there was anything there worth developing further. Initially, didn't have a lot of success, but they did discover that the herb Qingdao from before, remember, dear listener, let's put a pin out of that little cushion that we put in earlier, and that is an herb that we would call soft wormwood. And this was frequently mentioned in ancient Chinese medical texts in connection to malaria, and initial screenings proved promising, but not reliable. Until, in one ancient text, Tu Youyou read a specific segment that describes the medicine being prepared by submerging it in water and wringing out the juices. Almost all other preparations made Qingdao into a tea, which she then suspected might destroy the active compounds by heat. It also, like, isolated the active part of the plant, which is not specified in the ancient texts because they just thought it was obvious. But juices existed in the leaves, so that also solved that problem. Based on this, her team created a Qingdao ethyl extract, which they called Qingdao Su, and began animal testing in 1971 that had a 100% effectiveness rate.
Just fixed it.
Just done. Malaria,
done and
no. To speed up safety trials, in order so that they could do clinical tests before the next malaria season, Tu Youyou tested it on herself as the first human subject, with five of her co-workers also volunteering after her. Luckily, no side effects. The results were published anonymously in 1977, and eventually published in English in 1979. But then, wouldn't you know it, once Western scientists read it, they were like, okay, yeah, sure, traditional Chinese medicine, okay, lol. Because during the Cultural Revolution, there had been a propaganda campaign in favor of Chinese medicine over Western that maybe exaggerated some traditional Chinese, like, medical techniques more than was scientifically reasonable. But wouldn't you know it again, it actually worked. And it worked really well. However, due to similar suspicions of Chinese, like, industry and the Chinese pharmaceutical sector, when global efforts ramped up to eradicate malaria, artemisinin wasn't the go-to cure until 2003, when it finally became the primary choice of treatment. And it is now used in combination with other anti-malarial drugs in a treatment known as ACT, artemisinin combination therapy, which is now the standard treatment for malaria. And one of the things that I got so angry about is when the medicine was presented to the WHO, they examined it, like, themselves, they do their own tests, but their own tests were headed by American scientists from the US Army.
Mm-hmm.
And they just did not believe that artemisinin could be injected using a water-based solution. So they use an oil-based solution instead. And it didn't work as well.
Mm-hmm.
So when the WHO examined the medicine, they were like, well, this doesn't work. And it was only until other countries like India and Thailand did their own tests outside of the WHO that people could, like, come to the WHO and be like, you're not doing it right. You're not doing the science right. It works, you idiots.
Mm.
And so it took so long until it was actually adopted. Because people don't believe the Chinese for some goddamn reason. And that's the history of malaria and some treatments.
So the last thing I want to talk about is the future of malaria. So on one hand, advances in medicine, such as the development of new vaccines, and rapid testing kits will hopefully alleviate the burden of disease. On the other, malaria and other vector-borne diseases are likely to increase in incidence due to changing climate conditions. The main biological factors affected by the climate are the abundance of Anopheles species, their sensitivity to the parasite, the mosquito's lifespan, and the parasite's proliferation inside the mosquitoes. Temperature and precipitation are the two most important factors determining malaria distribution and severity. While heavy rainfall destroys mosquito larvae, that's the good news, the periods of humidity following rainfall are associated with high rates of mosquito proliferation. High temperature is strongly associated with increased malaria incidence because high temperatures increase the mosquito's activity and basically make them more aggressive. They want to bite more.
I didn't know that part.
Yes. So overall, climate change is believed to not only increase the burden of disease in tropical regions, which are already affected, but also lead to an increase in the global distribution of the parasite and therefore the disease. So, you know, yet another reason to be worried about climate change, as if we didn't have enough.
Yeah.
I always feel a bit weird whenever I mention climate change in this podcast, because like I always want to end it on a positive note or like a hopeful note, being like, but we as humans, we need to look to the future with hope and determine ways to combat climate change.
I
which feels...
I will say this. I think that there is hope, not only like because it could lead to the parasite spreading.
Yeah.
Potentially, right? But we have had methods of dealing with that for thousands of years.
Mm.
Just by draining swamps.
Yeah.
And it has been effective. Like even like in the 1600s, Charles XIV of France actually like instituted like a tax relief thing. Like if you owned a swamp and you drained it, you wouldn't have to pay tax. And that helped reduce malaria rates drastically in France at the time. So like that happened hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. So if malaria comes back now, I'm sure we can be like, that swamp has malaria. Get rid of it.
Right. It is spreading towards higher latitudes, but I'm not worried about that because I know that people in the West are going to fix it. I'm just worried about it becoming worse in places where it's already a huge problem.
Mm.
Because like while we, again, like we have the technology, we just don't, the distribution is the issue.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what I wanted to mention, just to be perfectly fair. Like I don't, you know, I would like to finish the episode on a hopeful note and talk about vaccines and like new developments. But we also need to take into account like this huge issue that we're dealing with, which is climate change and the effect that it's going to have on infectious diseases.
It really is like an existential threat, like in so many ways, isn't it? But I don't have necessarily like a hopeful thing to give you like right before the end, but I have a funny story about malaria.
Let's hear the funny
like
story.
Like a funny story. Like malaria is usually not funny.
No.
But I have a funny one.
Okay, go ahead.
Or like an interesting one, rather. I had so much fun researching this episode, and there was so much I had to cut, but this story, I can't not mention it almost. And that is the story of 1927 Nobel Prize winner Julius Wagner Dreyerek, who won his Nobel Prize due to his innovation of using deliberate malaria infections to treat late-stage syphilis.
I feel like I've heard about this. We made a syphilis episode, right?
I'm not sure. I don't think we have, actually.
We have.
I don't remember. It's
anyway,
possible.
I vaguely remember us talking about this.
Yeah, it's a fun story in either way, because I just think it's so funny to like deliberately infect your patients with a disease to cure another one.
Yeah.
Because the way this works is right. Like syphilis can cause a fever, but not enough to kill the bacteria that causes syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
Malaria, however, can cause a fever as high as 41 degrees Celsius, which doesn't kill malaria, but does kill syphilis causing bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's simply a matter of treating the now malaria infected patient with quinine, which was available at the time. And there you go.
Mm-hmm.
You've cured late-stage syphilis decades before penicillin.
That's so creative. Everybody's so creative.
Seems like we shouldn't do that thing, but we did.
I mean, if it works.
If it works, yeah. He, bit of an extremist doctor in general, but this one...
Extremist meaning in his, like approaches to medicine or personal
both
beliefs? Okay.
Actually.
Again, many such cases.
Many such cases.
Okay.
So that's the final story. Malaria, the syphilis cure.
All right, that's the end. I need to actually leave very soon. So with that, it is time to say goodbye. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, follow us on social media, and leave a review on Spotify. Tell us what you thought. Ask us a question. Maybe we'll answer it next episode.
Please ask questions. We love that. We love answering them. They're so fun. We love to hear from you.
Once again, I love reading the reviews. It makes my day. This was our episode of malaria. We'll see you in the next episode.
Bye-bye.